This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 95th in a series of monthly interviews with security gurus, and I am particularly pleased to have today with me Charlie Miller. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm good. Charlie Miller is a computer security researcher with Twitter. Charlie is known for his elite hacker skills, having discovered and exploited vulnerabilities in lots of Apple software. His latest foray into car hacking is very interesting. Charlie worked for the NSA for 5 years as a global exploitation analyst and then at Independent Security Evaluators and Accuvant. Charlie has a BA from Northeastern Missouri State and a PhD in math from Notre Dame. He lives with his tolerant wife, two young sons, and a busted garage in St. Louis, Missouri.
Well, to be fair, the garage is now fixed.
I was going to ask you that later. So a no longer busted garage.
Yep.
Okay. Well, we'll leave in the part about the tolerant wife. How about that?
That's usually tolerant.
Cool. So let's start with Apple. I know that early on you did lots of fuzzing to find problems and then dove in when you found something interesting and shiny to create an exploit. Why do you suppose Apple was incapable of running a fuzzer for themselves?
Apple is a bit of a mystery, so no one really knows what they do. it's hard to say. I think when I first started, I was doing this back in 2007.
So yes, that's right.
A while ago.
Yep.
I think they probably just hadn't, they either didn't know about it or they hadn't really had the time or the resources to do it yet. I'm confident now they do quite a bit of fuzzing, and they obviously have the resources to do it. So I think it was quite a bit easier back then than it would be now. But I mean, the thing with fuzzing is different people do it different ways,
right?
Different fuzzers find different bugs, and so no matter how hard they try, there's no reason to think that some guy can't come up with a fuzzer that's going to find some bug that they missed.
Of course, yeah, that's true. Just because there's so many possibilities, it's a huge space.
Yeah, it's a huge space, and different fuzzers do different things, and different fuzzers find different bugs.
Right. So just after the release of the iPhone, you broke it through the mobile version of Safari. You're working with Avi at the time at ISE, right?
Correct.
How did all that happen? What made you guys decide to go after the iPhone, and how did it unfold?
Yeah, so again, this is a while back.
It's
my memory's a little shady, but so Avi had just gotten the new iPhone and was showing it off to us. And this was, it's kind of hard to remember now that everyone has smartphones, but back then this was a really big deal. That,
right.
This phone had pictures and like a real web browser and all this stuff.
It was like a properly done BlackBerry device.
Oh yeah, I suppose.
We can date ourselves.
Right. He was showing it off to us and wanted to know, and at the time I was already doing Apple research, and so I had already been fuzzing the desktop version of Safari.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was basically wanting to know if we could use that research to try to break into the iPhone. And so some of the bugs we had found and we're still looking at for the desktop version worked as well against the mobile Safari, the browser on the iPhone.
Right.
And so we were able to craft one of them into an exploit.
Right.
That's smart.
And I guess the next thing you did, you won $10,000 at the Pwn to Own security contest.
Yeah, for a different
Apple OS X, right, through Safari again.
Yeah, I have one against the iPhone there as well. But, for the very first iPhone exploit, we didn't win anything except, a little bit of notoriety, I guess.
Right. Well, you guys announced it at RSA, I remember, or something like that. Wasn't that the one?
We've done stuff on RSA. I don't know. It's a big confusion. I've done a lot of exploits against Apple, and it's kind of hard to give a try. very first exploit that was really sort of special, I thought, was that we wrote that exploit. This was before anyone had ever jailbroken the iPhone.
Ah, right.
And so we had to write an exploit without a debugger and without, any sort of shell or anything. So it was like very black box. It was very difficult.
Awesome.
And Yeah, the same exploit would have been much easier to do if we would have waited a couple weeks until they actually jailbroke.
That's a great story. And then the first time you won the Pwn to Own, you got $10,000, right?
Yep, yep.
That must have been kind of fun.
Yeah, that's good money. So now the Pwn to Own contest, which is going to be coming up here very shortly, now people are winning, you know, $50,000, $100,000. So
wow.
We got in a little too early, I think.
I remember talking about one of those over a drink or two at my bar. Remember that?
Yep. I remember that very well.
So tell us a little bit more about your methodology. So you have a special Charlie Miller type fuzzer. And then what is it that you notice that you go, aha, there's a bug right here?
So for fuzzing, for me, like, I'm mostly looking for memory corruption vulnerabilities.
Okay.
And so there's a couple. So the most obvious way is if the program crashes, then you know it's at least something to investigate. There's other ways you can monitor the software while you're fuzzing. You can use something like FileGrind or you know, something equivalent to electric fence or something, which instruments the heap so that you can tell when the heap's been corrupted without actually the program crashing.
Right. Those are the most interesting ones anyway.
Yeah. And those are the ones that are harder to find. And so hopefully they will last longer than say, like, so if you're fuzzing something, you figure Apple's also fuzzing it. So if you can do anything that you think they're not doing, then that's something that you'll maybe find a bug.
Right. And you sort of said why Apple. It was because the iPhone was shiny and new and Avi had one.
Yeah.
and you think they've gotten better at software security? At least they've gotten better at fuzzing, it appears.
Yeah, no, they've gotten better all around. So just on my limited data set of when I run a fuzzer, I find fewer bugs than I would have a while ago. And then they've also made writing exploits more difficult. So back in 2007, they didn't randomize memory really, and they didn't have data execution prevention and stuff like that. So they made a lot of things harder.
So all the stuff that Microsoft had done, they're now doing.
Yes.
Yeah.
So they basically do all the sort of industry best practices on that sort of thing now.
Uh-huh. So the next thing that happened, I guess, is Accuvant hired you to get them into the papers. And
they also had me, working with their clients as well.
But mostly,
one of my missions is usually to get in the papers.
Yeah, that's right. And well, you're like me. You're sort of the hood ornament of the corporation to some extent.
Yeah,
you get the bugs in the face that way. So Twitter, on the other hand, seems to have hired you to keep them out of the papers. So
right, yeah, I think that's basically my job there. And so far, so good, but.
Yeah.
We'll see how it goes.
So I'm interested to know, has the security approach at Twitter evolved since the IPO last fall?
So Twitter, I can't really talk about what we do there.
Right. So who knows? We'll just have to find out. I mean, I've been over there and met some of the people, and I'm just interested to know, to talk a little bit about what happens when you mature an approach from finding bugs and fixing stuff to really building a secure development lifecycle. Because I think that's something that a lot of companies are experiencing right now. And I think you probably lived through that, but you don't want to talk about that?
No. So the only deal I have with Twitter is I get to talk about stuff to people like you, but I can't talk about Twitter. So.
Fair enough. Let's talk about hacking cars then. Because
you talk about that.
Because you're doing that.
Your car can't tweet. It's fair game.
I don't think it's going to be too long before cars tweet.
I guarantee there's cars out there that can tweet.
Yes, they can. Actually, that'd be a hilarious hack to make a car tweet, but it'd probably get you in trouble. So now in your spare time, I guess, you've been focused on hacking cars. And your work is way better documented and much more public than Yoshi Kono's, which we talked about just a couple episodes back in Silver Bullet. Why is it that your work coming from non-academia is so much better documented and published with the code and all that stuff than Yoshi's coming from academia? Why do you suppose that is?
Right. So Yoshi's group, when they published their two big papers about this, and their papers were excellent. They covered everything you can imagine, from sort of the remote aspect of things to how you would then control the car physically afterwards.
Yeah, they even had some cool
great
videos.
Papers. Right. But one of the things is they never share any of the sort of technical details. They wouldn't even say what kind of car they had used.
Right.
And I think some of that was based on the types of grants that they had gotten, and you know that they weren't allowed to talk about things. But
right. So the NSF constrained them a little bit or whatever.
I imagine. I don't know for sure.
You know, I bet it was Dean's, but I'll ask Yosh next time I talk to him.
Yeah. I think the other part of it was that it's sort of a different, you know, philosophy that they were very worried that if the details of their attack was released, that some bad guy would use it to, you know, hurt someone.
Right. Right.
Where, and that's certainly a valid concern, but we took the, my partner Chris Valsack, who works at IOActive,
yeah.
We took a different approach, which was that, yes, you know, there's certainly, you know, some risk in releasing all the details. We released every detail of, you know, that we learned. There's a risk in that, but I think that the risk is, the benefit is greater than the risk, and the benefit of everyone can look at this, they can see how it works, we can have informed discussions about how to fix it.
Yep.
I think the details will really matter as far as having a discussion on how to make cars safe.
I completely agree with you, Charlie. I think that's the right decision. And not only that, if somebody's going to attack another human, going through their car is rather silly. There are way more effective ways to do it that are way cheaper.
No, definitely. And even if you want to wreck someone's car, there's way better ways to do that than through the computer as well.
Right.
So, yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's certainly a fact. But for me, I just like a big part of research was trying to get tools, get them out in researchers' hands so that we can all start looking at the problem instead of just letting the car manufacturers.
Right. So you wrote this fantastic paper called Adventures in Automotive Networks and Control Units. Can you give us a 2-minute flyover of that paper?
Sure. So it's like an 80-page paper. It's very tough. But basically, we talk about the networks that are inside of all automobiles and how the little computers inside your car talk to each other. And then we talk about two particular cars that we looked at, which was a Ford Escape and a Toyota Prius.
Mm-hmm. Where'd you get those, by the way?
So we bought them, we just got them from a used car dealer. But the actual money, most of the money for that came from a Cyber Fast Track grant from DARPA.
Oh, cool.
So, yeah, so, I mean, that's another thing that makes car research so hard is that like, most researchers, you know, they don't want to wreck their cars.
Yeah, when you brick a car, that sucks.
Right, exactly. And believe me, neither of the cars that we got, like, run anymore.
So I was going to ask you if you bricked them, and you did, huh?
Well, I mean, they're worse than brick. They're like piles of bricks. Yeah.
I guess you can sell it for scrap metal.
I guess if they would come get it, you know, I'm not going to be able to move it.
I love it. So there's even a towing fee involved.
Right. So yeah, that's where we got the car. But anyway, so we figured out like some of the proprietary messages are sent on these. And how you could, if you were an attacker and you could send messages on this network, how you could get the car to do things like, you know, lock the brakes or make the brakes not work or turn the steering wheel and that kind of stuff.
That's amazing. So you're taking advantage of what's called the CAN bus, right?
Right. So most cars have run on the CAN bus. And all, like I said, the computers, which are called ECUs, there's like a computer for your brakes, a computer for your seatbelt, a computer for your airbag. They all have to talk to each other, and they do it over this bus.
Right. And the protocol for that bus is pretty well documented.
So the underlying protocol is there's standards for that. The problem is each car, and each manufacturer for each model each year has different data that they send. And so while you can see the messages, you know, they're very standard, the actual data is totally proprietary and you have no idea.
Right, so you sort of have to figure out when we see a packet that looks like this, it's probably talking to the brakes.
Right, so the way the CAN network is there's no sort of addressing either source or destination, so it's just a bunch of messages being broadcast to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And so that makes it kind of hard to figure out what a particular message is doing. It also has security implications in that I can then send a message, and there's no way the receiver can tell whether it came from, you know, the
yeah, no anti-spoofing, no sort of anomaly detection or whatever.
Right.
I mean, some of these devices that are talking on the bus have got to be manufactured by different companies. And they probably manufacture parts that compete with each other. So one of the things you could do if you were an evil car supplier would be to make your competitor's gear appear to just fail.
You could do that, and you could probably actually not only make it appear to fail, but you could actually make it fail. So,
yeah, but I mean, make it appear to be their fault that, you know, they just build faulty crap when it turns out that you're just attacking your competitor.
But some of these ECUs you can, and we showed this in the paper, you can actually, over the CAN bus, you can reprogram the firmware. So
yeah,
you can actually
amazing.
Reprogram your competitor's firmware to make it actually fail.
We'll be right back after this message. This is Gary McGraw, your host for the Silver Bullet Security Podcast. If you like what you're hearing here, you should check out my monthly security column published by Search Security and Information Security Magazine. You can find the most recent column at searchsecurity.com/McGraw. All of my writings are collected on my webpage at www.sigital.com/gem/writings. Thanks for listening. So, I mean, look, thinking about this from, oh, some bad guy comes and hacks your car through the CAN bus is different than thinking, oh, some third-party vendor that creates a component that is intentionally malicious in a sneaky way, that's a much different threat landscape, and I think one that might get the automotive manufacturers to sit up and take notice.
I'm not sure what will make them take notice. They haven't taken notice yet.
Really? So zero response from any of those guys?
Well, we gave Ford and Toyota a copy of our paper before we published it. And Toyota never contacted us directly. Ford, we had a discussion with some of their engineers just to sort of go over the paper with them. But since then, there hasn't been any discussion.
No. Wow. That's just sort of amazing. But it's very, very early days in car land, I think.
Definitely.
Yoshi seemed to insinuate that he was having a good conversation with the American Society for Engineers or something like that, car engineering. Did you talk to those guys?
Yeah. So I can't remember the exact name of that organization either, but yeah, we also had a call with them and went over the paper, and they definitely seemed more receptive to the discussion. I think the difference is that car manufacturers, they don't want people to think their cars aren't safe.
Right.
Because they want to sell the cars. Where this organization that is of automotive engineers, they actually care about this, the safety and the security of vehicles.
Yeah, right. We had a similar situation in the smart card wars back in the 90s when Visa and MasterCard were working on security, but they didn't want to talk about the fact that they were working on security because they wanted people to think everything was secure.
Right, exactly.
So it took some doing at the top to get them to say, yeah, we're actually working hard on security, and here's the sort of stuff we're doing to protect our brand. But they turned the corner. It took, 5 years of serious banging and Paul Kotcher, outing them in the news and all sorts of stuff. But they did turn. So I think you guys are sort of the first salvo here, and the car manufacturers will probably turn the right way.
They'll have to. I mean, if nothing else, the very absolute worst case scenario is someday some bad guy really hacks into a car and really hurts someone, at which point they're going to really, very quickly have to make some changes. So
yeah, and they'll be caught in with their pants down the same way the Ford Pinto guys were, where they knew about that problem and they didn't fix it because, they figured it wasn't that, it was rare. And then when it killed somebody, it turns out that the fact that had been written down in someone's filing cabinet really matters a lot when you're talking about liability and culpability. Yeah, it's early days, but I do hope that they start listening to you. So the Ford Escape and the Prius are toast. Are you going to buy more cars? I mean, what's your plan to push the work forward?
So right now we're working on, there's a few things. So we finished up some research on how to get more researchers involved to where you could do car research without having to buy a car.
I see. So get all the electronic components and put them together.
Right. And we have a paper we're working on that shows how to do that.
Awesome.
But right now what we're working on is basically the defensive side of things.
Oh, one thing about that before we move on. That means what it would be a factor of 10 times less to to get ready to do some car research then?
Yeah, that's our goal, is basically if we can do it for 10 times less than the cost. So if a car costs $30,000, if we can give you something for $3,000,
cool,
then you know, that's a win.
Right.
So yeah, so Chris and I both have these rigged up go-karts with all the car pieces from like the Ford and the Toyota.
Awesome. So you did go-karts with those? That's really cool.
Yeah, they're pretty fun. So this is work we're going to be discussing at Siskan in March.
So. Okay, great. So coming up soon.
Coming up soon.
And I'm sorry that Chris couldn't join us today. He's in Japan because we would have been happy to have him here talking with us too. So hopefully in the future we'll catch up with him.
Yeah, about this research at a conference there in Japan.
Cool. And you said you got the garage fixed, so that's good.
Yep. So yeah, the garage. So I was doing some testing of the Escape and had some messages that wouldn't make the brakes not work, and I pulled into my garage like an idiot. You know, sure enough, the brakes don't work. And when the brakes don't work, and you're driving in your garage, you eventually hit something. So I had.
Did you just have to shove it into park and you know hope that it stopped that way?
I mean, I don't know what happened. It was all kind of a blur, but I actually accelerated, and then I realized, that there was a problem. And then so yeah, right before I hit the wall, I put it in the park, and I don't know for sure if that stopped it or if hitting the wall stopped it, but eventually I did stop.
I'm sorry to laugh, but that is just a crazy scene to think about it, you know, because you're really working. You're
funny.
Like totally in the groove, and then all of a sudden you go, oh, no. You got a split second of, oh, no.
I mean, by the time I realized it was happening, if I would turn to the left, I would hit my house. If I turned to the right, I would hit my actual vehicle.
Oh, man.
And so the only thing I could do is just shoot right down the tunnel there into the garage.
What's on the other side of your garage?
My backyard.
And, oh, that's good.
Air conditioner and stuff. So yeah, I was really happy I didn't hit the air conditioner.
Yeah, and you wouldn't have gone into the kitchen had you gone through the wall. So.
No. So luckily the garage is sort of off to the side of the house.
Is that the most ridiculous, fun sort of story that came out of the car hacking stuff? Or
that one was the most ridiculous, maybe not the most fun. I think probably the most fun was just showing off the various attacks to the reporters and stuff. So
yeah.
we got reporters in the car, and then we would attack them, and you know they would
freak out.
They so much wouldn't be quite so freaked out, but typically they would hire a camera guy for the day who had no idea what was going on, and so then he would be very.
Oh, man. I mean, I guess you'd sort of have to really be driving in order to experience the, oh, no, the brakes don't work feeling.
Right. Yeah. Once your brakes don't work, driving a vehicle is a completely new experience because it's something you just take for granted that your brakes are going to work when you press them, and all of a sudden, you know, even though you didn't get in an accident, like just the fact that you know that one time you press the brakes and nothing happened, it changes
your view of cars, doesn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, you learn about this happened to the airplane guys. You know, you used to yank on the yoke, you could actually feel the control plane that you were moving around to move the airplane, and now it's all fly by wire, so you don't really feel the feedback. It's just it's a funny thing that we've created for ourselves as humans. I wanted to ask you something you probably can't talk about as well, but what the heck? So any thoughts to share about the Snowden stuff?
So, yeah, I mean, I can't say too much about that, but I think that when it first came out, everyone was, at least the people I talked to, were very much sort of against Snowden and he's this traitor and all this stuff. And I kept saying, well, you know, he's really gotten us talking about this topic, and you know now we know things, and we can sort of bring NSA to task on these, and I think more people are kind of coming around to that idea.
That was always my perspective, you know, so I think that's the right way to look at it.
Right. So I don't know if I want to give him a medal or anything, but I definitely think that you know if he hadn't leaked all those documents, we wouldn't be having the conversation we're having now about NSA and surveillance. And
it's an important conversation.
No, definitely.
Yeah, and I mean, we don't really know what the right answer is. We can't say, well, it should be this way unless we have that conversation and we all agree as a society. I think that's the problem. I mean, the other issue is, of course, you go to Washington and you figure out these people that are in charge of oversight and you just go, wow, some of these guys don't even believe in evolution. What are we supposed to do with guys like that?
Yeah. No. And there's plenty of evidence that, you know, the NSA will say one thing to the Senate and then the next day, you know, something's leaked it.
Oh, yeah. The clapper thing really bothers me. But
right. Well, so there's a lot going on that, you know, we need to have as much transparency as possible. And if nothing else, Snowden provided some transparency.
Right, right. It's interesting that you have that similar perspective, even though you spent 5 years working on that stuff directly. I guess you were doing something completely different than what Snowden was doing as root, but it's interesting times, that's for sure. One other topic. Do you think we're making progress in software security? Are we finally getting past the bug whack-a-mole days?
I think we've given up on bug whack-a-mole, basically. So I think that the approach has switched from, and I think Adobe is sort of the one that really opened my eyes to this, is that we switched from trying to find all the bugs to just trying to make it to where even in the presence of bugs, attackers can't win.
Right.
And so we've spent more time working on exploit mitigations and sandboxes and that sort of thing. And it's much easier, you know, these are engineering problems. And
yes.
So, you know, we can engineer things. It's just we can't do things perfectly. And so if we can reduce the amount of code the attacker has to look at to just the sandbox code instead of the whole browser or the whole Adobe Acrobat reader, then, you know, that's basically an easier battle to win.
Yeah, I think that's right. But that means that when you build the sandbox, you really have to pay very special attention to software security.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
And then then what happens is you basically have moved the battle also from, say, the web browser to the kernel.
Right.
And so it's just, you're just shifting around the important code in your system. But, you know, obviously we still have to write good code and make sure that we do it as good as we can. But,
yeah, and there's always going to be code to attack, so we acknowledge that, but we try to make it as expensive from an economics perspective as possible so that the payback is not really worth it. You know, in some sense.
I mean, that's all you can do is make it hard enough that people don't want to do it. And, you know, for whatever it's worth, like, I stopped doing Pwn because for me, it wasn't worth the trouble anymore. That it became hard enough to write exploits and find bugs that, you know, it wasn't worth the effort for me.
Yeah, you know, that's kind of an interesting point. So sometimes we get asked to write exploits when we found a vulnerability for a customer, and we'll say, well, we could, but it's very hard to write an exploit, but you still have the vulnerability. Why don't you just fix it instead of paying us to write an exploit? And we used to have that conversation a lot more 10 years ago than we do now. So I think that people are in some sense demanding exploits less than they were before, and that may be a sign of maturity.
Yeah, I think that's a sign that people at least understand what an exploit is and that they exist and they work. And so, you know, hopefully, and like you said, it's so much cheaper just to fix it than to actually write the exploit.
Right.
You know, if you're a consultant or something or work for a company, it doesn't make sense really to write an exploit.
We had a funny experience recently where we found a problem in a random number generator from a company that I won't name right now. And we sent it in to them through the usual channels. And they said, well, you know, we can't write an exploit for this. And we said to them, it's math. You don't need an exploit for that. You just need somebody with some crypto sense to look at this result. It was very interesting conversation because the guys at the front of this battle in the response centers, they're just used to exploit code and, you know, they're looking for stuff like no op sleds, and we're like, no, it's just bad math. Interesting times.
Yeah. And, you know, those companies that you're reporting bugs to, they're not supposed to be able to write exploits. They don't sell those. That's not what they do.
Exactly.
You know, write good software. And so if someone like me says that you can exploit something, you just fix it. You know,
yeah.
That's not where the art is about.
Yeah. And now, I mean, you're at the stage of your career where if you say it's exploitable, people are going to believe you instead of like, who's that guy? No, I think it's true, Charlie. And you've done some really amazingly good work and been very clear about how you've done it the whole time, which is commendable. It's not magic. It's just hard work.
So, oh, yeah, definitely. And I would never say I'm the best bug finder or the best exploit writer in the world by any stretch of the imagination.
The thing that you do is you make it really clear so others can understand how you did it and think about that when they're building a new system.
Yep. Yeah, I talk about it. I say how I did it. I say when I fail. I'm given lots of talks where basically the punchline is it didn't work. So, that's part of research.
But you're sitting here anyway, listening. So speaking of listening, I wanted to find out if there was any music on in the car when you drove it into the garage.
Oh, I don't know about while I was actually driving the garage, but I will tell you this, that when we bought the car, it had a James Brown CD in it.
Oh, so, awesome.
Like, that's just sort of the music for the car hacking.
Do you know which CD it was?
Oh, no, I don't know. I don't know.
Man. Yeah, we got it. We have to link that up for sure. So that's the car hacking music is James Brown.
Yep.
Really cool. Well, thanks, Charlie. It's been a very interesting conversation. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yep. This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Sigital, an IEEE security and privacy magazine, and syndicated by Search Security. The January-February issue of IEEE S&P Magazine includes articles about Snowden and the NSA, smart card networks, and our interview with crypto warrior John Callis, which I encourage you to listen to. See www.computer.org/security for more. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.